Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a perennial issue that divides, if not dominates, American politics, and that is abortion, now returning to center stage with Paul Ryan on the Republican ticket. Best-selling author Frank Schaefer joins us. He is the son of Francis Schaefer, who began the anti-abortion movement in this country and was one of the founders of the religious right. We will discuss this latest round of abortion politics brought on by Paul Ryan, who opposes all forms of abortions, including those for victims of rape, as well as all forms of contraception. Then, as the proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran over Syria is not just being fought in the streets of Aleppo, but is raging over the airwaves across the Arab world, we will look into the media wars in the Middle East. An expert on the Arab media, Marwan Kredi, a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, joins us to discuss the double standard in coverage of the Arab Spring revolutions by Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. Then finally, while Mitt Romney was in Ohio today accusing Obama of waging a war on coal, the president visited Iowa to tout wind energy. Dr. Harold Pryor, the founder and executive director of the Iowa Wind Energy Association, joins us to discuss a thriving and growing industry that employs 75,000 Americans and generates 50 gigawatts of power, an industry that Romney dismisses as imaginary and Ryan says is a fad. Joining us now is Frank Schaefer, who is the best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. Frank Schaefer, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. Frank Schaefer's novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma. And his non-fiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism. And his latest book is Sex, Mom, and God. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Schaefer.
Nice to be with you again, Ian.
And as I mentioned in the opening here, Frank, Paul Ryan is bringing back abortion politics into the 2012 race. It never, of course, goes away. The United States, I think, is the only country in the world where abortion not only divides but seems to dominate American politics. And do you think that, given that Romney chose Ryan, at least the assumption is on the part of the punditry, is that he chose Ryan to shore up the Tea Party and to get them motivated, do you think that there will be an equal and opposite reaction on the Democratic side, that the presence of Ryan on this ticket with somebody that is so radical in terms of his economic visions, but also in terms of his attitude towards women and women's rights, being as hard-line anti-abortion as you could possibly be, do you think that will also have a motivating factor on the Democratic side?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of factors here, Ian. You know, my background with the anti-abortion movement goes back to the early 1970s when I worked with Dr. C. Everett Koop, who became Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General, to make a film series called Whatever Happened to the Human Race with my father, Evangelist Francis Schaefer. And we basically got the evangelical wing of the pro-life movement rolling. One of the people we worked with then was the Roman Catholic bishops. One of the interesting things about Paul Ryan, just to get started here, is that his own bishops have denounced his lack of Roman Catholic consistency when it comes to his economic plan, which would be an Ayn Rand smash at the poor in favor of billionaires. So here we have a Republican ticket with probably the most brutal far-right economic policy coming from the same man who's got the most brutal anti-woman policy. So it's interesting for me to note that the seamless garment that some pro-lifers talk about, where you have to be anti-war, anti-capital punishment, anti-abortion, anti-contraceptive, also includes activity on behalf of the poor. Ryan is that particular type of Roman Catholic that chooses to be a good Catholic and faithful to the most radical Vatican position when it comes to denying women of not only their right to abortion, but to contraceptives. But when it comes to the social policy of the Roman Catholic Church, he's a straight in-your-face Ayn Rand libertarian to the extreme. So it's a nasty combination, because it's inconsistent with both Roman Catholic teaching on morality taken in its full spectrum. Whether you agree or not, it does have a logic to it when it's in its fullness. And it is, of course, horribly inconsistent with the views of most Americans, 52% of our population being women, give or take a couple hundredths of a point, who believe that it is their right to choose when they want to have children and choose methods of contraceptives. So we have an odd situation where the Republican Party are calling President Obama anti-religious because he wants Roman Catholic institutions to extend health coverage to women and provide contraceptives on one hand, and on the other hand, this is the same group of people who now have a vice presidential candidate that is so extreme on the abortion issue that, for instance, he backs the types of initiatives that lost 20% to 80% in two successive Colorado elections and were even defeated in Mississippi, stating that even a fertilized egg has to be counted as a full person, which would outlaw not just in vitro fertilization, but many forms of the pill. So we've got a real extremist on the ticket now, which clearly defines where the Republicans are coming from. And you say, will this hurt? Well, it will only not hurt if people believe the Fox News version of reality. But anybody who actually digs into Paul Ryan will find a person who is brutal toward women, no matter what smile or glad-handing package this comes with, and equally brutal toward the poor. And it's an odd combination. And I say again, in defense of the Roman Catholic Church, which I'm not a member of and not particularly favorable toward in many ways, this is not the pro-life ethic that the bishops hold forth, which may or may not be right. That's a different debate, but is certainly consistent when it comes to, for instance, saying that the rights of all human beings have to be guaranteed, including the unborn. Ryan is not of that school of thought. Ryan does not believe in the rights of all human beings. Women are second-class citizens in his world, as are the poor, and he holds up only one part of Roman Catholic teaching faithfully and has dismissed the rest of it on the basis of being an Ayn Rand disciple, not a disciple of Jesus Christ.
Well, it is a little hard to take. I mean, one can understand and sympathize with those that are against abortion, and I've never known anybody that's ever had an abortion that thought it was anything but a horrible experience. And it's easy to be sympathetic to the idea that to the pro-life idea. But if you combine that with a ban on contraception, which would seem to be the way to prevent and avoid abortions, it makes no sense logically to me.
Well, you know, Ryan is a real extremist, even in the anti-abortion movement. There are lots of people who call themselves pro-life, who believe in contraceptives, who believe in in vitro fertilization, who believe in abortion for women who choose that route after rape or incest. He is the most doctrinaire type of anti-abortion advocate. Look, he introduced a bill in Congress that would federalize the vaginal probe requirement that was basically laughed out of court in Virginia and prevented the governor of Virginia from being a serious consideration for Romney's ticket. Now he has somebody on the ticket who introduced this same idea in federal law. So we've got a guy who tried to federalize mandatory vaginal probes for women and examinations that they didn't necessarily want, that was tossed out of other states that were reckoned pretty conservative on this issue, and of course it didn't go anywhere. He's against contraceptives. He wants the Roman Catholic Church to have the right to deny women contraceptives who work for them as part of their health plans. He calls a fertilized egg a full person and has initiated legislation to recognize the personhood of a fertilized egg, which would deny women the use of the pill. You know, he is not even mainstream pro-life, as the term is normally understood. This guy's on the fringe of even that movement when it comes to his views. And I say again, because it bears repeating, except when it comes to the poor. Where it comes to the poor, he is like a caricature of an Ayn Rand clone, and would increase taxes on the middle class by $2,000 per family on the one hand, and on the other hand, attack programs for the poor that are the safety net that keep people from a miserable fate, defund Medicare through a voucher program, and attack Social Security, which he is against simply on the basis that any federal program to him is suspect. So, you know, I think as people get the measure of this guy, as the election goes on, from any truthful source, they're going to realize that this is a unique vice presidential candidate. I can't think of anybody in my lifetime that's been a serious candidate of either party who has been from such an extreme wing of that party. And I think he takes the cake on this.
Well, he also is in favor of the privatization of Social Security, which George W. Bush tried in his second term. And of course, had he succeeded and as the market crashed in 2008, there would be essentially no Social Security left. However, that's apparently Ryan still holds to that belief. Now, again, I'm speaking with Frank Schaefer, who's a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robinson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. He, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. He's been an author of best-selling novels, and his latest is Sex, Mom, and God. So, given, people are starting to sort of digest and figure out who he is. I must say, Frank, I was watching CNN this morning, and I saw a debate on CNN with Donna Brazile, who ran Gore's campaign, ran it into the ground, arguably. She was there as a Democratic spokesman or spokesperson arguing against Ryan, and there was somebody else arguing for Ryan. And listening to this, and I thought, oh, my God, the Democrats are dead in the water if people like Donna Brazile are arguing for them, because she was absolutely passionless and pointless and boring. And then I saw Ryan live speaking in Colorado, and he really was good. There's no two ways about it. And he's been constantly reelected in a blue-collar, working-class district in Wisconsin. So he's perfect for the Republicans. He's the perfect guy to peel off the so-called Reagan Democrats, the Joe the Plumber types. And today, Romney was standing in front of a bunch of coal miners in Ohio with a phalanx of these big, burly, white, working-class guys with hard hats on, delivering a speech about how Obama is waging a war against coal. So I wouldn't discount the possibility that these guys can get elected.
They can get elected, and they might get elected. And Democrats and independents who care about the fate of the United States have got to energize this process from the other side. One of the problems is that in an age of television and image and sound bites and Twitter and the rest of it, you know, who's going to actually bother to see what anybody's record is? Instead, we look at the image, and Ryan has a good one. He's white, and we have a black president, so that's great, because it relieves everybody on the right who's got a tinge of racism in their heart of any dubious sense of, you know, well, those sort of the other strange people are in Washington. He's part of a team that is very slick and, of course, has incredibly deep pockets with people like the Koch brothers and others behind them, far deeper than the pockets on the Democratic side of the pack. But the fact remains that if one goes by the adage that actions speak louder than words, no matter how well-presented he is and humble and pleasant on stage and well-read and can quote things and come over as a good guy and a nice deer, you know, fellow deer hunter and guy who heads into the woods and all the rest of it, the fact is that if you look at what he's actually sponsored in Congress and his budget and his writings and his record of speeches from the past, there is no way to duck the fact that he is an extremist, and he is not the type of extremist that can be elected by an American public that's informed on his record in terms of the majority of Americans, including working class Americans. So yes, I think the potential for them to win is there because the Supreme Court has opened the door to top-down funding on a scale we've never seen from people like the Koch brothers, and we live in an age of television and image more than ever, and we have a black in the White House who is hated, not disliked, but hated viscerally by many, many people on the Republican side who are energized to the extreme, partly because of racism, partly because of the fact that Barack Obama is someone who represents to them this liberal agenda, which of course is laughable because he's a centrist, if anything. All of that combines to a very, very dangerous situation. On the other hand, if Ryan's anti-woman, war on women record when it comes to abortion, contraceptives, towing the Vatican line to the extreme that even the American nuns disagree with these days and got in trouble with the Vatican for being more ambivalent on these things, if any of that can be brought out, combined with the fact that he's, you know, we talk about his views on abortion, going back to what I wrote about in my book Sex, Mom, and God, which really traces the rise not just of the religious right, but the philosophy that actually formed people like Ryan, with my friend Jack Kemp and others who I knew personally and talk about in the book, and working with them to inculcate the anti-abortion view into the party as a litmus test. Ryan is cashing in on that, and he's basically been bred for this moment. So, you know, I would urge people to read Sex, Mom, and God if they understand how somebody like Ryan can emerge. In this case, I actually knew his mentor personally well, which was Jack Kemp. Congressman Kemp and I and Dr. Koop and my dad sat down in Jack Kemp's basement for three nights running, watching the film series we made, Whatever Happened to the Human Race, which basically launched the evangelical pro-life movement. Jack was Ryan's mentor. Ryan worked for him. Ryan was nurtured at Jack's bosom. We had a lot to do with Ryan's views on abortion through the Kemp family. And so Joanne Kemp, who's an old friend of our family and used to have my mom and dad stay in her home, was sitting there in the front row down there in Virginia and was recognized from the stage by Ryan. You know, I don't know Ryan personally, although I bet I did meet him as a young man when he was in Jack's office, because I was in and out of the office all the time, but I don't remember. However, it's interesting to me, as I said at the beginning of this show, that what I talk about in Sex, Mom, and God, which is this preoccupation with other people's sexuality on the part of the religious right, is the only part of the Roman Catholic teaching which has actually transferred into Ryan's agenda. The rest of it, when it comes to compassion for the poor, serving others, following the example of Jesus Christ when it comes to the view of wealth as opposed to sharing, in those areas he's totally departed, and what he is a disciple of Ayn Rand, as my friend Jack Kemp was. And interestingly enough, I have a piece that I've written that I'm going to place in the next couple of days, talking about how my dad, actually, as an evangelical, helped change Jack Kemp's mind, at least on one point, and that was when Jack was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, he did not have this slash and burn anti-poor campaign that Romney and Ryan have launched based on Ayn Rand, because my father actually talked Jack out of it and told him that since he was an evangelical Christian, he had a duty to the poor. And Jack actually implemented some of that teaching. Apparently, Ryan has nobody like that in his life. His own bishops denounced his budget, and he didn't change it. All he did was, in 2012, distance himself from Ayn Rand by saying that he was a Roman Catholic and preferred Thomas Aquinas, you know, which is kind of an odd way to try to get out from having spent a whole lifetime quoting Ayn Rand as your central philosophy. That's where he comes from. So he is a very presentable, very good speaker, very kind, self-effacing, good with children, if you want to put it that way, nice with crowds. Fact of the matter is, he's the most radical anti-abortion candidate that either party's ever put on a ticket, and he's the most radical Ayn Randian that any party has ever put forward. This guy is straight out of central casting when it comes to screwy libertarianism on one side, off the wall anti-abortion activity on the other. And I say again, if people want to understand where he comes from, read my book, Sex, Mom, and God, because that is what this is all about, sex, mom, and God. And you'll notice, you know, that the sexual preoccupation he brings to his campaign of trying to stop women having even access to contraceptives is, you know, right out of what I'm trying to explain in the book that has two chapters on the rise of this movement.
Well, Frank Schaefer, I thank you so much for joining us here. We've just been speaking then with Frank Schaefer, who's a best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction. His parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, were world-famous evangelical speakers and authors, and he previously worked with such figures as Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Focus on the Family's James Dobson. Frank Schaefer, however, felt increasingly alienated and experienced a crisis of faith that would ultimately lead to his departure from the evangelical movement. Frank Schaefer's novels include Portofino and Saving Grandma, and his nonfiction books include Crazy for God, Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism, and his latest book is Sex, Mom, and God. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a specialist on the Arab media about how they are covering the war in Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marwan Crady, who's a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. He's the author of Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, Arab Television Industries, and he's currently working on three book projects, including Global Media Studies, The Contentious Politics of Arab Music Videos, and Real Worlds, The Global Politics of Reality Television. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marwan Crady.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
The foreign ministers of the Islamic Cooperation Organization are meeting in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and they've called upon Syria to be suspended from the 57-nation bloc at this emergency two-day meeting going on now in Saudi Arabia. Only Algeria and Iran have objected, since they are supporters and allies of Syria. But in the broader context, it's pretty clear that there's a kind of proxy war going on between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And Syria is the focus of that, if you will, what the contention is over. And a lot of this is, my understanding from talking to people in the region, is that a lot of this is playing out on television. So there's a kind of a proxy war going on television, with Al Jazeera on supporting the Saudi Gulf position and Iranian and Syrian state media supporting the opposite position.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's not just the current chapter in Syria, but it's been going on for a while. Lebanon and Iraq have been arenas for proxy media wars between the Iranians and the Saudis for a number of years now. Obviously, Bahrain to some extent, but nowadays what's really the most important story is the story in Syria. And you have, on the one hand, the Gulf satellite channels, the Qatari Al Jazeera, the Saudi Al Arabiya, some of the Lebanese channels supporting them. And on the other hand, you have some of Iran's outlets. They have some Arabic language outlets, such as Al Alam television, and some of the Syrian channels, including the state channel, but also some private channels close to the regime. In addition to some Lebanese channels, for instance, Hezbollah's channel, that are taking the other side. So it's very much a battle of the airwaves over the Syrian story that we're witnessing. And the most notable element of this is the rise of really what in the West we might call hate speech. in terms of identifying the players by their religious affiliation, imputing all kinds of political behavior, violent behavior to the religious / ethnic affiliation.
So this then is laying bare the Sunni Alawite Sunni Shia divide. In what kind of terms would it be comparable to here in the United States? What kind of level of bigotry are we talking about?
Well, we're talking, there are different levels of bigotry. So, you know, on government-owned channels, for instance, you don't see any kind of extreme levels of bigotry. But unfortunately, it's become a lot cheaper to launch a satellite channel. So you see with Iraq and now with Syria, there's a proliferation of channels with, you know, very shady backers, with dubious funding, and the level is absolutely extreme. I mean, you hear expressions calling each other pigs. There was a famous statement by a Sunni cleric in Syria that said that Alawites should be ground meat and will be thrown to the dogs. It's these kinds of very extreme demonizing the other, accusing the other of describing them as animals, as disposable, as vermin, as virus, as all those extreme words that you know, we don't very often hear and perhaps in other contexts.
So what's then the difference or the distinction between the more respectable, shall we say, outlets like Al Jazeera and these kind of shady operations that you just described? What would be the demographics or the numbers we're talking about? I imagine that the listenership for Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya aren't they pretty dominant throughout the entire Arab world?
Yes, they are dominant. So first, you have a difference in the size of the audience. Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya claim to command the attention of dozens of millions of Arab speakers, while these other operations, you know, if there's any way to know, I haven't found it, how many people are watching them, but we can safely assume they have a much smaller audience. Now, in terms of style of coverage, you see reports on the more mainstream Gulf channels that, for instance, begin using the words Alawi or Alawite and Shabiha interchangeably. So that what that does, it somehow makes every Alawite in Syria a thug that's working for the regime violently to suppress others who are also defined as Sunnis. But you don't directly, at least not from the anchors, not direct editorially, you don't hear words like, you know, comparing the others to animals, but you do see it on videos. So, for instance, even the mainstream channels may use and have used videos from YouTube, for instance, or supplied by this or that group, where there are extreme terms that are used, and they sometimes don't edit them out.
Again, I'm speaking with Marwan Crady, who's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. And he's just returned from the Middle East. So I've seen some coverage of the Syrian war, recent coverage, on Al Jazeera. And I must say, they really do get their cameras in there. And I suppose the issue here is that the Syrians have basically made it impossible for any news coverage to come out, for them to try and control it. So for a long time, the opposition, as it got organized, was basically getting its message out via YouTube and social media and other means. So to some extent, the Syrians are, you know, to blame, are they not, in as much as they don't want, they're trying to control reality, aren't they?
I mean, the Syrian regime is obviously trying to control reality, and it's not, let's just put it this way, it's not winning the propaganda war. I think what's very important, though, is that just like you have, just like in regular warfare, when you have a kind of a conventional army versus a guerrilla formation, the guerrilla formation is losing as long as it's not winning, and the regime is winning as long as it's not losing. And nobody had any illusions about the propaganda of the Syrian regime. But there were hopes that on the other side, we would see relatively truthful, fair, representative coverage of reality. And unfortunately, several things. There have been a multitude of incidents that have really cast a negative light on all these, on a lot of the media messages of the opposition. There have been scandals about fabricated videos. There have been people who have been forced to say things, all kinds of things like that. So I'm afraid I have a hard time believing either side in this propaganda war. And I do see that in Western media, there's a tendency to privilege the media of the opposition. I, for one, I'm deeply skeptical of both sides.
Well, there are, of course, a handful of apologists for the Syrian side. I've talked to a lot of Syrians with the what are they called, the coordinating committee spokesperson, yeah. The English language spokesperson, and you know that you're not talking to a journalist, you're talking to a propagandist. But it's pretty slim pickings out there for a journalist. Who do you talk to, you know?
Very slim pickings, and unfortunately, it's an extremely dangerous story to cover. Several people have already died, and this is the problem, and this is why I've described in the past the situation in Syria as what I called Plato's digital cave. It's a game of echoes and shadows and people who are faceless and nameless. There are voices, there are images. It's very hard to trace them back. It's extremely difficult to know to what extent they correspond with what's going on the ground. There are many attempts coming from all sides at all levels to deceive and to create competing narratives. It's a very, very difficult situation to figure out. Now, in the last month or so, there are more journalists that have been going in. But so far, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen that having a positive effect on clarifying the picture to the public about what exactly is going on in Syria.
Again, I'm speaking with Marwan Krady, who's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics. Now, when Al Jazeera started, of course, it started with a lot of BBC alumni, and it has had a hard time getting traction here in the United States. In fact, I think it's during the Bush-Cheney years, there was an open hostility towards Al Jazeera. They're actually on this radio station that I'm speaking to you from, Marwan. I think 3 p.m. we carry their news. They're also now on PBS. So they are getting some traction here. How do you think, though, their brand has been affected in terms of their objectivity? Because I know their coverage of Bahrain was, I think, pretty biased because that's pretty close to home. And we're talking about their coverage of Syria, which is also has opened up to charges of bias.
Yes, I mean, one of the things, so to just as a disclaimer, I don't believe in something called objective media. You can be balanced, you can be fair, you can be thorough, you can be diligent. Al Jazeera was earned the admiration of many people because of some of the coverage that it did before the Bahrain crisis. And, you know, several of us who observe the media scene in the Arab world had our doubts about the channel because we kind of knew what was going on in the background. But the Bahrain story was a killer for Al Jazeera's credibility. The channel was extremely enthusiastic with the Tunisian uprising. It was quite enthusiastic in Egypt. As soon as Bahrain began, there was a shift. Part of it is a bigger, broader geopolitical backdrop of a reconciliation between the Qataris and the Saudis. Al Jazeera was actually born during a feud between the Qataris and the Saudis for a long time. It was a weapon, basically an anti-Saudi weapon in the in the hands of Qatari foreign policy. With that reconciliation, we saw Al Jazeera aligning itself more and more with editorial policies of, for instance, Al Arabiya. And it lost a lot of its credibility, I believe. And that is why I think it would be foolish to not connect this shift in Al Jazeera's editorial line with its broader acceptance in the U.S. We had Secretary of State Clinton making a statement about Al Jazeera. I don't think that's very good for the channel, though. I don't think being identified with any of the parties in any conflict is good for any media institution. But I do think Al Jazeera's credibility has been shaken from Bahrain onwards.
So specifically, my understanding, Marwan Krady, was that the original idea for an Al Jazeera-type network was taken, the proposal, if you will, was taken to the Saudis. They turned it down, and then the Qataris took it up. And you're saying that it became a weapon between the Qataris and the Saudis, in as much as there's no question that this tiny little country has got an enormous amount of credibility and exposure out of this channel, has it not? And by contrast, the Saudi royal family, who have Al Arabiya, they're not getting the same traction, are they?
No, in the sense that, you know, Al Jazeera is, in some studies that were done in the past decade, was a more recognized brand globally than the country of Qatar itself. You're talking about a very small country, which is not the case with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is very well known. It has the holy places of Islam, oil. It's a major power regionally. And so, of course, its status was not expanded as much by Al Arabiya as the status and the influence of Qatar was by Al Jazeera. But nonetheless, you know, for a long time, Al Jazeera started in 1996, Al Arabiya in 2003. From 2003 to 2011, an Arab viewer could reliably get two contrasting versions of the same story by switching between Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera. If you watch Al Jazeera, it would cover a story in one way. Al Arabiya would cover it in typically a very different way. And since the Bahrain story started, there's been a convergence of the two channels. And I think that's bad for both of them. There are signs that things might change again. We know that the Qataris and the Saudis are sponsoring various different groups, in some cases competing groups, in post-revolution Egypt and Tunisia. And so there could be changes again. But for now, that convergence has made the two channels quite similar.
So they're on the same page in Bahrain. They're pretty much on the same page in Syria. They're pretty much on the opposite pages, aren't they, in Egypt? The Saudis have funded the Salafists. They came out of nowhere in the parliamentary elections. A lot of the Egyptian specialists I talk to, people in Egypt, say that it was Saudi money that made a huge difference there.
Absolutely. The Saudis sponsored the Salafists and kept trying to protect Mubarak and the holdovers from his regime. The Qataris sponsored the Muslim Brothers, and so there's a rift there that could eventually, be manifest in other countries, and it is to some extent, and lead to, again, a kind of a colder relationship, in which case we might see the coverage of these conflicts on Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya differ again. Mm-hmm. But for now, they're very eerily similar.
But surely, from the point of view of the Arab viewer, they got to see the hypocrisy, haven't they, of the Saudis supporting the despot Mubarak and wanting to topple the other despot, Assad.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, Bahrain was the most evident in this matter. You know, the Saudis have had upheaval in the eastern province as well. And it's covered minimally on Saudi media, and when it's covered in a way that this is the good government and these are the deviants or the terrorists or the, you know, the outlaws. And so, of course, the viewers, Arab viewers now are among the most sophisticated in the world just because they've been exposed to so many different views on different media. In fact, the convergence of Al Jazeera on Al Arabiya has opened the market for new channels that are more similar to Al Jazeera's old editorial line. One of them is called Al Mayadeen, which I had been following quite closely for the last few weeks. It started in this summer in Beirut. It was started by one of the leading figures of Al Jazeera, Ghassan bin Jiddu, who resigned because of the way Al Jazeera was covering the Syrian crisis. And he said, you know, I cannot work under these controlled conditions. And he started a channel with funding that some people say there's Iranian funding. I don't have precise information on this. But it is covering, for instance, the Syrian crisis in a more balanced way than Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, although it tends to cover it from the point of view of the Syrian regime. Well, and we still don't know how well it's going to be received, but early indications seem to indicate that it's doing quite well.
Well, I spoke with an American journalist, Max Blumenthal, who was hired by a Beirut operation. I wish I could remember the name exactly.
Al-Akhbar.
Al-Akhbar, there you go.
Yeah.
And he quit because he felt that they were getting totally biased in terms of being backpedaling and soft-pedaling the atrocities of the Syrian regime.
Yes. And, you know, this is what's so interesting, is that what's going on, I think, and we're going to see more flux in the next year or two, is a redefinition of the Arab media landscape. The lines used to be very clear. You had the Saudis controlling most of Arab media. You had against them, you had Al Jazeera, you had a couple of London-based newspapers, you had a few Lebanese newspapers, a few Syrian newspapers, and that was it. And what's going on with these revolutions, the whole landscape is getting redefined. You know, in Egypt, for instance, now the Muslim Brothers are basically purging a lot of the satellite channels from influence that they deem to be undesirable. Al-Mayadeen, if it has an impact, because people feel, okay, I watch Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, they give me the same version of the story. If this new channel's audience grows very quickly, some of the other channels might have to reconsider their editorial lines. Not all of them have hundreds of millions of dollars that are available to them as long as they're following the government's directives. So I think the whole landscape is in flux, which makes it quite interesting to observe.
Well, I just did a piece yesterday about the Israeli press, who are absolutely, in a frenzy over the possibility of Netanyahu and Barak attacking, bombing Iran in the fall before the American elections. There's not a peep of it over here. So, my sense is that the Middle East, whether it's Israeli or Arab media, is far more energetic and diverse and interesting than our media. And we're slaves to this convention of the binary convention that in the universe of ideas, there are two equal and opposite black and white opinions. And I think that's absolutely cripples us, this phony balance that we have.
Absolutely, absolutely. And let's not forget that whether you're an Iranian, a Syrian, an Israeli, a Lebanese, even a Turk, what's going to happen will have a direct impact on your life and safety and the safety of your loved one. While for many people here in the U.S., it's really a theoretical debate. I don't want to say academic, but it doesn't have the real-life implications. And therefore, the debate here tends to be a lot less robust than it is in the Middle East.
Right, because it's based upon a falsehood that everything is equal and opposite, and that somehow it denies the possibility of convictions and passions and opinions, and we all have them. And the idea that you can hide your opinions in the name of balance is a hoax, I think. Because
absolutely.
Well, that's another discussion. But I thank you so much, Marwan. I've enjoyed this discussion.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Marwan Crady, who's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. He's the author of Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, Arab Television Industries, and he's currently working on three book projects, including Global Media Studies, The Contentious Politics of Arab Music Videos, and Real Worlds, The Global Politics of Reality Television. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the founder of the Iowa Wind Energy Association. President Obama was in Iowa today touting wind energy.
A rap burglar, false media, we don't need it, do we? It's fake, that's what it be to you, dig me? Yo, Terminator X, step up on the stand and show these people what time it is, boy. Don't believe the hype.
I listen to the wind of my soul. Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows. I've sat upon the setting sun, but never, never, never.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Dr. Harold Prior, the founder and executive director of the Iowa Wind Energy Association, where he previously served as the president of the board of directors from the organization's inception. A retired school administrator, Dr. Prior has been involved in wind energy since the 1990s. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Harold Prior.
Ian, it's great to be with you.
And today in Ohio, standing in front of a phalanx of hard-hat coal miners, Mitt Romney accused President Obama of waging a war on coal. And conversely, in your state of Iowa, the president was standing on a sunny day with a backdrop of cornfields extolling the virtues of wind energy. Now, tell us about the reality of wind energy, because as the president pointed out today, and Mitt Romney has suggested that wind and solar power are imaginary sources of energy. And the vice presidential nominee, Paul Ryan, has been equally dismissive of wind energy. What kind of a reality is it?
Well, first of all, Ian, thanks for the opportunity. And you know, I'm not going to comment about the coal industry because obviously our focus and our interest is on the wind energy industry, both in Iowa and nationally. And what I can tell you about the wind energy industry is, number one, you know, the wind energy industry only seeks to be a legitimate part of a balanced portfolio of all sources of energy generation. And the goal of the American Wind Energy Association, the Iowa Wind Energy Association, the United States Department of Energy also, I believe, is 20% of our generation nationally from wind by 2030. And the thing that the wind energy does as much as anything for both rural economies and urban and suburban economies is it brings a huge amount of distributed revenue sources and increased manufacturing opportunities to a state like Iowa. For example, Iowa leads the nation in the number of wind-related jobs at approximately 7,000. We lead the nation in the percentage of our electricity generated from wind at 20%. And we were the first state in the nation to realize 20% of our electrical generation from wind. Finally, in the rural areas, it brings wonderful operation and maintenance jobs that pay to start $40,000 to $50,000 a year, that appeal to young families with school-age children, and it takes a significant number of these jobs to maintain the operation of the utility steel turbines and the wind farms in the rural areas of our state. Furthermore, our farmers and landowners realize annual lease payments for these turbines of anywhere from $6,000 to $10,000 per turbine per year. And that's typically a 20 to 30 year contract for the landowner. And finally, in terms of the rural areas, what these turbines contribute to the local tax valuation base is pretty incredible. Each of these utility scale turbines in Iowa will generate about $900,000 of additional assessed valuation to help raise needed tax revenues for our counties and some school district budgets. Finally, the wind energy industry, because Iowa also leads the nation in the number of component manufacturers and supply chain and wind-related companies that are located here in Iowa, creates terrific employment opportunities in the manufacturing and service sectors in the urban and suburban parts of our state.
Well, already, it seems, Dr. Harold Pryor, again, the founder and executive director of the Iowa Wind Energy Association, already there is in this country 50 gigawatts of wind energy is being generated and 5 gigawatts of solar energy is being generated. And this is way above an energy forecast, the expected 40 gigawatts by 2030. So clearly the U.S. is way ahead of the targets that were previously set. Why do you think there is this opposition? For example, as I mentioned earlier, with Mitt Romney suggesting that wind and solar power are imaginary sources of energy. It sounds 50 gigawatts or 55 gigawatts, that's real energy.
Well, yeah, and I can't speak to Mr. Romney's rationale for his position, but by the end of this year, I can tell you that with over 10,000 megawatts under construction nationally, we're going to be well past 60 gigawatts of total installed capacity nationally. And that should be probably 5 to 6% of all the energy generation in the United States will be from wind by the end of December of 2012. And so interestingly enough, when you look at the statistics, it will take an estimated 300 gigawatts of installed capacity to reach the 20% of all generation from wind goal for the United States. And at 60 gigawatts, we'd be 20% of the way there, which again, as you said, and I want to add these statistics, is way ahead of the projection. And we can continue this progress of growth if we get those modest production tax credit credits renewed by Congress and signed into law by the president. And, you know, this is not like Solyndra. This is much different than that. These are payments for actual electrical production that actually go against the wind farm owner-operator's federal tax liability. So it's not like a cash grant or anything like that. It's money that is in the mix of the economics of the project to actually return the investors money and really assure a profit for the generation of the wind energy from a given wind farm investment. And so, you know, one of the things that makes wind so attractive is that there is no underlying natural resource cost. You know, we don't have to worry about spikes in prices like we do with coal, oil, or natural gas. And because the wind raw material is free, can't be speculated, can't be controlled by anyone. And so, you know, it gives the surety for the cost or the price at a wholesale level of wind energy to remain very constant because there are not price fluctuation variables out there like there are for other generation methodologies.
So, again, I'm speaking with Dr. Harold Pryor, the founder and executive director of the Iowa Wind Energy Association. And today in Iowa, President Obama touted wind energy, and he also talked about how 37,000 jobs nationally have been created, and they would be at risk if the wind tax credit is not extended. It's facing Republican opposition. He also went on to take a dig at his opponent, Mitt Romney, saying Mitt Romney said new sources of energy like these are imaginary. His running mate calls them a fad. During his speech a few months ago, Governor Romney even explained his energy policy this way: you can't drive a car with a windmill on it. And then President Obama took the opportunity to make a crack at Romney, saying, I don't know if he's actually tried that, driving a windmill on top of his car. I know he's had other things on his car, clearly referring to the family dog that was strapped to the top of the car. So how do you feel about being in the grist for the political mill, Dr. Pryor?
Yeah, some people might say it's a signal that our industry has really arrived.
I think
it's a great opportunity to explain to people the fact that wind energy is the second fastest growing method of generating electricity in the United States over the past 7 years. And over the past several years, the wind energy installations have increased at about a 35% a year pace. And just a minor correction on the data, as I understand it, that you referenced. I think according to the American Wind Energy Association, nationally, the wind energy industry has created about 75,000 jobs. About 37,000 are at risk if the production tax credit is not extended.
Well,
and actually, we believe that if the production tax credit is extended and stays in place with our current pace of growth, the wind energy industry would probably likely create 500,000 jobs in the next 10 years.
So what is the downside of wind energy? We know the downside of coal is it's the worst polluters and contributing to CO2, the cause of global warming. We know from the Fukushima meltdowns and other nuclear accidents the perils of nuclear power. What's the downside of wind energy?
Well, frankly, Ian, I can't think of a single one. You know, our industry does not create any sources of pollution. In fact, the wind energy industry, especially at a time when we have record-setting droughts, is one of the few electric generation methodologies that does not use huge quantities of water. And, you know, there are really no pollutants associated with the wind energy industry. We have some opponents that like to exaggerate with claims about, you know, shadow flicker and damage to birds and you know, maybe it messes up their view of the horizon. But most of their claims have been disputed. These turbines operate very quietly. I've actually climbed 5 different times in a utility-scale wind turbine. I've stood right below them and granted interviews. I've had Representative Tom Latham set on top of 235 feet and do an interview with an Iowa Public Radio reporter. And basically, wind turbines are a marvelous example of American ingenuity and another great example whenever people see them for economic development, job creation, and moving us towards an energy independent nation.
So it doesn't kill birds. Is that what you're saying?
The studies that have been done about wind turbines and birds is that more birds are killed by flying into unopened windows, moving vehicles, and feral cats than are killed by wind turbines. And those are individual statistics. In other words, feral cats kill more birds annually than do wind turbines. Birds flying into unopened windows die at a higher rate than from wind turbines. I live in Northwest Iowa. I'm an outdoorsman. I hunt around these all the time, and I have never yet seen a dead game bird at the bottom of a wind turbine tower.
Well, I guess your point, though, is well taken, Dr. Harold Prior. If wind energy is now a grist for the political mill, then it's something real, although politicians tend to often argue about unreal things. I guess we all should be gratified, right?
we'd love to have Governor Romney just reassess his position on the wind energy industry. It's not like Solyndra. It's completely different. Many leading Republicans in Iowa, Senator Grassley, who's known as the father of the production tax credit, he was the sponsor of it when it was started back in 1992. Our Governor Terry Branstad, Representative Tom Latham, Representative Steve King, all leading influential Republicans in Iowa politics are very supportive. They sing the praises of the wind energy industry all the time, and just as they are, we're doing the same thing. We're really hoping that Governor Romney will reassess his position on the wind energy industry and be able to understand that, you know, it does one of the things that his campaign is all about, which is the creation of good-paying American jobs that can't be outsourced. I mean, these jobs are going to be here for the foreseeable future surrounding this. So we just asked the governor if he just, you know, please reconsider his position on this production tax credit and take a closer look at all the positive things the wind energy industry can do for our economy and job creation.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Harold Prior.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Harold Prior, who's the founder and executive director of the Iowa Wind Energy Association, where he previously served as the president of the board of directors from the organization's inception. He's a retired school administrator, and Dr. Prior has been involved in wind energy since the 1990s. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.